Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Hey, I'm Brian Hyatt, and this is Rolling Stone Music Now. Hope you've had a great week. We are going to talk about an album that has its anniversary today, and with me to talk about it is Andy Green. Welcome, Andy Green.
Hi, thank you very much, Brian. How are you?
I am okay. So, we're going to talk about two albums, actually. The first album, three, technically. All right, well, one that came out 20 years ago today, and that is U2's Pop, and two that we sometimes combine in our heads, at least I do, into one album, which is Human Touch and Lucky Town by Bruce Springsteen, which came out 25 years ago as of like the end of March. So it was Mr. Andy Green noticed this coincidence, and it actually provides us with the opportunity to have an interesting discussion about when great bands, great acts, have moments of what I would call artistic confusion. Do you think artistic confusion is the right phrase, Andy?
Yeah, though I love Pop. You know, I have a different take on it than you may. But I think in both cases, they were coming off huge periods of success, but musical styles were changing rapidly, and they were entering a new era, and didn't quite know how to operate in that new era. And it caused some problems.
Yeah, I think that's part of it. Actually, it's a very complicated and parallel story of both albums. I think we'll start with out of order with Pop.
Yeah.
So Pop is Pop came out, of course, 20 years ago. Horrifyingly, was 1997. How do you feel about that?
I feel somewhat weird. I mean, I recall it very vividly, so it's weird. It's 20 years.
It's upsetting, and so. U2 was trying to do what, you would say, with Pop?
They were trying to embrace dance music to some degree and to move on from to advance Zeropa. I think they experimented a lot on Zeropa, found success with it, and they wanted to take the next step and have more like electronic sounds on an album and sort of be modern. They wanted to keep evolving, and bands like The Prodigy were getting popular, and Madonna was doing Ray of Light. I mean, there was sort of, this style of music was entering, you know, like the pop field on pop radio.
Right.
Yes.
And they were, as always, trying to be relevant. And Matt maybe will cue up Discotheque while we talk, and he'll let me know when it's ready, just so we can remind ourselves where we were at with U2 and Pop. But basically, they were trying to find a middle ground between a rock album and an electronic album. In fact, they started working on the album without Larry Mullen there, mm-hmm. which he was greatly aggrieved to learn. So, and they were working with Nellie Hooper, who was a producer who worked with Massive Attack and Bjork. So it could have been awesome.
Yeah, I think the problem is that they sort of wussed out. They didn't go the whole way and do an album straight through like Discotheque and Mofo and Do You Feel Loved. The first three songs are of the same style, essentially.
Right.
And then it goes right into If God Will Send His Angels, which is more classic U2.
Well, there's a lot of problems. I think that would be the first problem would be the sort of wussing out. They got a little scared. They got scared of diving fully into the thing. But there was also, it was more complicated than that, because also the rhythm section, Adam and Larry, did not want to be replaced by, you know, program loops. So there was this attempt to recreate the sound by playing live. And let's hear a little bit of Discotheque. You can reach,
but you can't grab it. Yeah. It's this great guitar band trying to not use the guitar as the central thing, though he's playing on that. It just doesn't sound at all like
bad
style.
Example, bad example.
I'm aware of that because of his solo on here and everything. It's an awesome solo.
No, excuse me. That actually has a great guitar riff.
What I meant to say was it's not the ringing guitar style that he was using his whole career up to that point.
Better way to say it, yes. He was, that is definitely true. They took away the characteristic edge sound of guitar. Yeah. That is actually, I think that's actually one of his core guitar moments because it's genuinely funky. One of the things that they struggle with on this album is even when they do attempt to groove, and I was listening to it again today, and one of the things that struck me is there are moments when they attempt to groove, and this is something the band themselves, especially Bono, has said, they don't groove right. It doesn't, the grooves can be very clunky, and that is a bit of a problem if you're trying to make a dance record.
Right, yeah. And the backdrop of all of this was that Bono's voice was going through a very rough patch. He was smoking cigarettes, there was dryness issues, his voice was struggling, and they did a really big mistake. They booked the tour, so they had a stadium tour locked in that gave them a very hard deadline.
Yes, when you're making the most experimental album of your career, perhaps it is not super smart to have the hardest deadline in the world, which is a stadium tour booked that you have to play the music on, and you just have to finish the album. They snatch the album away from you and put it out before you're done with it, basically.
And The Edge says that he was doing background vocals during the mixing stage at the very end, which is unheard of.
Well, it's not that unheard of, but yes, it is a thing that happens, yes. But yeah, right, they were down to the last minute, and it is true. I mean, I've been fortunate enough to the final stages of No Line on the Horizon, which was another album that they were kind of finishing last minute, and then sometimes they have the burst of inspiration and they get all the way there. And you see how, you know, and U2's process is fascinating and unique. You know, I think for people who don't like them, I think one of the things that would be interesting is to learn about their process and how hard they will have. Now, I don't want to segue all the way over to No Line on the Horizon, but it was interesting to see, like, when they had a song called Breathe on that record, they had two entirely different versions of it. One was about, like, I think Nelson Mandela, and the other version was the version that ended up on the record. And so that's how they will finish two versions of the same song and then kind of like choose between it. That's how crazy they will get. And on Pop, I think one of the things that their then manager said, Paul McGinnis, was they were just realizing the potential of digital. So they would have takes that were minutely different, or, you know, like 100 tracks bringing up and down, and they got lost in it a little bit.
Yeah, and they put out Discotheque as the first single, which is similar to The Fly being the first single off Octoon Baby. You sort of lead off with your thing that's more experimental. And then they had the ace in the hole of the song One for Octoon Baby, and their ace in the hole off Pop, or they thought was Staring at the Sun.
Yeah, Staring at the Sun, which maybe Matt can get ready. But Staring at the Sun, I was listening to it again. It has a great chorus. It's very much the other thing that was happening in that era was Oasis.
Yes.
And Staring at the Sun is in its chorus kind of an Oasis chorus. And it happens to be a really good chorus. I'm not so sure. There's a couple things wrong, and this gets into some deeper issues. The arrangement isn't quite right, and this is all stuff the band acknowledges. This is pretty much just what the band themselves would say, and they're right. The arrangement isn't quite right, and it's possible the verses aren't that strong either.
Yeah, and the band has said that if they had one more month, just 4 more weeks, they could have made it great.
It's possible they would have made it worse too, of course.
Yeah, they have a long history of overthinking stuff, but when they toured Pop, in the first few weeks, they played Staring at the Sun the same way as the album.
Well, what's your the album version of Staring at the Sun, briefly?
Yeah, and
yeah, so, well, when you hear that, you're like, hey, that's a hit single, but the problem is that's like the 10 seconds that was the hit, but it's also like, the lyrics are pretty cerebral and abstract, and, you know, they were, And the issue of the lyrics in the album is a whole separate issue, because I think it was a real step forward for Bono, and lyrically, and actually it's, people have written like long essays about this struggle with God in the lyrics of pop.
Yeah.
But let's go back to the because there's so much, there's actually a lot to talk about. The other thing is, and we'll jump ahead and we can go back to the actual album itself, but the marketing and release of this album was equally fraught. And this is one of those things why it's a perfect storm, much like Human Touch and Lucky Town, because they chose to call it pop, first of all, which was a terrible mistake, right?
Yeah, I mean, it was meant to be ironic in a certain way, that these weren't real pop songs.
Back in the 90s especially, there really was a species known as rock fans. I guess they still exist. But rock fans did not... They heard the word pop, and they were immediately suspicious. And then what do? They released Discotheque, which, by the way, is one of my single favorite U2 songs. I love Discotheque. I think it's fantastic. But they not only released a song that is, to the ears of a 1997 rock fan, very electronic... What do they do in the video?
They dressed them up as the Village People, and they danced, and they had to beg Larry Mullen Jr. to put on the cop outfit. He did not want to do it, but he did it. He has a nightstick. He has like a little nightstick thrust move that he does, and to your average rock fan, they're watching their favorite rock band like prance around like the Village People to some song called Discotheque.
It's almost like if you wanted to make a plan for sort of commercial suicide in 1987, right. That would almost be the plan.
But it was the sound of a band with great confidence, because the 90s had been going so well for them.
Right.
And Octoon Baby was a very bold move, and it paid off in such huge ways.
Yes, and in a way, the album feels inevitable, because they were carrying on from what had been some of the most successful moments of their last couple albums.
And Zeropa started off as an EP, became a whole album, and a song like Numb was a hit of sorts.
Right. I would imagine that when you have like basically the Edge talking and that becomes a hit single, there is an air of invincibility.
It's just
rising.
The Edge muttering. The video is just feet being rubbed in his face, and it was everywhere.
Yeah, so So, you're setting yourself up for a fall at that point.
Yeah, but my favorite U2 is U2 that's reaching for something. It's confident U2, it's bold U2, and I love pop because of that, because there's no fear there. There's just complete faith in what they can do and reaching forward, and they don't always hit it. There's songs like the Playboy Mansion and Miami that I detest.
What is that terrible line about OJ? If OJ is not just a drink.
And if Coke is a mystery and Michael Jackson history.
Yeah, it was, I mean, you know, again, Bono himself has said that those lines are no good.
Yeah, you should never put lines into your songs that refer to the pop culture of that moment.
Well, I also don't even understand the OJ is a drink thing. I think he was just setting up a rhyme.
He's saying, I think the line is if OJ is more than just a drink.
More than just a drink.
Yes.
That's no good. Lyrics weren't mostly the problem, but it is this sort of struggling in a new era thing as well, because as much as they were carrying on with their own electronic experiments, they were also trying to, as much as we think rock is dead now, there was this sense, and especially in the sort of European circles that they traveled in, that rock had become extremely dated, and they hated grunge. I mean, you know, for the most part, especially the Edge, he really disliked a lot of grunge, and they felt that was, you know, and they're not wrong about this. They felt it was white, conservative, boring, and they wanted to be modern and none of those things.
Yeah, and if you turned on the radio then in Europe, you would hear The Prodigy. You'd hear Firestarter. That was everywhere.
Right. For The Prodigy were on the cover of Rolling Stone that year. Yes, yeah.
Yeah, so it seemed that they were being as modern as possible. But, you know, they keep saying now that they want to go back and fix it, and they fixed a bunch of the songs in their minds on the various compilations and on the tour even. They kept working at it.
What in your mind is the most underrated song on pop?
Gone. I think maybe. Gone is a masterpiece.
Maybe Matt can cue up Gone. But there are moments of real excellence on the album, but it does require that patience, because one of the things about being like sort of a super fan of a band is having the patience to be like, okay, I'm going to listen to this song where the arrangement isn't quite right, but I know there's a great song there. And that's, not everyone has that patience.
And I think one problem was they didn't have Daniel Lanois, they didn't have Brian Eno, they didn't have their usual filters that could really talk back to them and be like, yo, this song sucks. Like, this song Miami sucks, guys.
Or the, I kind of, yeah, I like Playboy Mansion.
I hate it. I hate it. It's better than Miami. Yeah. And If You Wear That Velvet Dress is also a very nice
yes.
song.
And I like Wake Up Dead Man. I kind of like the second end run of the album where it kind of peters off into oddness. That's interesting to me.
Yeah, it's sort of, that last song, that's really weird. That Wake Up Dead Man, that's a outtake off of Zeropa that they reworked a lot.
Right. So we're going to hear Gone for a second. I get to feel so guilty, got so much for so let
out. Then you find that feeling just won't go. Yeah, it's a really cool groove, and
no,
on
I don't
stage,
think so.
I think it's a cool groove, and on the tour it sounded great, and on the 01 tour, if you watch the Live in Boston DVD on Elevation tour, they destroy it. It sounds amazing.
What I would say is that's a perfect example of what I was talking about. I really like that song. I mm-hmm. think as a record it does not work, and I think that beat, especially now, yeah. Does not work, and I think it's because of. It's just when you make your rhythm section do weird contortions to do a thing that they're not good at, that's kind of what you end up. And that's the problem with like sort of flawed albums is like you have to have the patience to be like, ugh, this groove isn't working, but hey, the lyrics are good, the song is good. It's just this funny thing that's what a real fan does, is they're willing to look past these problems or even like sort of. There's this very interesting thing where you end up sort of being a producer and trying to figure out in your head like how to fix this as you listen to it, you know?
Uh-huh. Yeah, and I just think about poor Larry. He had to go through Passengers, which was their weird 95 thing with Brian Eno. That was even more experimental that he hated. Then he was forced to go do this.
Yeah, it was pushing the boundaries of the band, and you know, you always think, looking back, that it was inevitable that U2 would always stay together and U2 would have a comeback. I mean, you know, they were a little bit adrift after
and
that
then
record.
They were forced to go on a stadium tour all over the country and the world, where these songs are the focal point of it.
Well, that's the next part of this. There is the pop tour, which I saw. I'm sure you saw.
No, I didn't see it.
Oh,
I was a little too young, and
they
didn't play Cleveland.
I mean, Andy, you kind of love U2's pop, don't you?
It's possibly my favorite U2 album, and I know that sounds insane. Partially is I was 15. It was the first one I bought. My introduction to U2 was watch them play Please on the VMAs.
Yeah, I have no memory of this, but this made a real impression on you.
Yeah,
on you.
It was the same year as the Puff Daddy Sting thing.
See, that I remember.
Yeah, well, this was right in the middle. It was the middle of the Pop Mart tour. It was a real low point for the band. Bono was like wearing a hoodie. It was very un-U2 looking, but it just really impressed me. I think Please is the best song on the album. It was much better live. And there's something about, I like the boldness of it. I like the fact that there's no flop sweat on it. It's just them reaching and sort of not quite getting it. But for me, it just clicks straight through, besides the two songs on it that I can't stand.
Yeah, I mean, maybe we can hear Please for a second from Matt. But, Pop Mart Tour is, of course, what lends the whole thing a reputation of semi-disaster, because they went for a semi-ironic presentation, the giant lemon.
Yeah, they felt the need to top Zoo TV,
so what
which
did they,
was really hard.
Tell the world about the giant lemon.
Yeah, what they wanted was a stage that was like a pop art stage. So they had a giant... They had a giant arch on the stage that was like a McDonald's arch, basically.
Right.
They were worried about being sued, actually. Then there was a giant lemon, and during the encore break, they would ride back on this neon lemon and then get off of it, and it was supposed to just be ironic, but in a very Spinal Tap-esque moment, the lemon, it would occasionally freeze and the doors would close and they'd have to exit through some hatch door in the back.
Yeah,
and they were trapped for a while.
The getting stuck in the lemon is a classic rock and roll moment. What was your Please again? So you never knew love until you crossed
the line of gray. And you never felt it was this same time the Stones were touring Bridges to Babylon, and I saw Jagger talk about it, and he was like, they booked 10 cities too many.
Wow.
You know, and he was right, because there'd be shows in Tampa or something where it was a stadium of 80,000 people. And even if you draw 40,000 people, that's a lot of people. It's a half-empty stadium. It looks horrible.
I remember I saw it at the Meadowlands, the Giant Stadium, and first, I believe Fun Loving Criminals opened up.
I think they did a lot of the tour. As did Rage Against the Machine did a part of the tour.
See, that would have been so much better. So we have Russell from Florida calling in, and he agrees with Andy. He says that U2's Pop is a very underrated album.
Let's hear from Russell.
Hey, Russell, how you doing?
I'm doing well. How are you guys?
Pretty good. Thanks for listening. So what is your case for U2's Pop being an underrated album?
Well, in my opinion, I think it's got some of the best songs they've ever done. I saw the tour. I saw the show in Memphis, and I thought I was blown away by it.
Did they get stuck in the lemon? Did they get out of the lemon safely in Memphis?
Didn't. I thought that was great.
Okay.
You know? So, but I mean, like, Gone, Please, Last Night on Earth, I think those are three of their best songs they've ever done, personally. And I think, unfortunately, I think they fell into the Billy Squier Rock Me Tonight problem. The video, exactly. They let off. I mean, I get the whole Fly, you know, Octune Baby thing. I understand that. I think Discotheque's a great song. But I think the video kind of did them in terms of more of their classic rock fans.
Yeah.
You know, the fans that loved the Joshua Tree and loved War. I think they lost a lot of them along the way. And then back, what you were saying about the VMAs, I loved them doing Please on the VMAs. And if only Bono had gone more Bono-esque, I've always said this to my friends, if Bono went more Bono-esque, they would have sold another million copies of that record.
Yeah.
You mean if his hair was long and stuff, it would have been less...
he performed it.
Right. And, yeah. Yeah, and I mean, in the first half, I mean, it wasn't until the end and the buildup of the song that he kind of went all Bono-esque. But, you know, like you said, he walked out in the hoodie and he just stood still, you know, for the first, you know, 3 minutes of the song before finally kind of breaking out a little bit. I think that if he would have gotten a little more into it in that performance, I loved it. I mean, I'm a super fan. They're one of the few bands I would actually travel to go see. So,
yeah.
But,
well, you know, Russell, it's funny when you said that. Now I remember the performance when you talked about him standing still. Well, I remember it.
And the host was Chris Rock, and he said Bono was dressed up as like the Unabomber.
So anyway, yeah. I mean, and Russell, before I let you go, I will say, like, when in one of my cover stories, when I was spending time with them, on the tour behind No Line on the Horizon, they were on the 360 tour. No, excuse me. What was it, right?
Yeah, that was 360.
On the tour that I spent weeks on, I can't remember the name of. So on that tour, they had the remix they were doing, that moment, the head bobbing moment, and the fans really, I loved it, and they threw in a little bit of Discotheque, and the fans did not like it, and their response was, sometimes our fans are just not as groovy as we would like. So I think that's what we ran into. So anyway, Russell, thanks so much for calling in, man. Have a great day.
You too, man. Thanks, guys.
All right, bye-bye. I agree that Pop is an underrated album because it has so many good songs on it. I just question whether it works as an album qua album, given the problems with the arrangements.
But what you should do, it's very easy to just reconstruct Pop off the live performances and the big remixes on the singles and the 90s compilation.
Well, what you should do, Andy, for all of us is make a playlist of this on, you know, Spotify and tweet it out to everyone, because I think we'd all like to see your, you know, and then maybe you two can also, we know those guys, maybe they can hire you to remix the album as well.
Yeah,
that would be cool.
I think that a Pop box set one day will be incredible.
Absolutely. So let's see. I mean, you know, we've covered the tour underselling, which I think really knocked their confidence off.
It was just in America in a few markets. When they went to Europe and South America, it was packed. The shows were incredible. They sort of made the show great as they went, but it was the Vegas opening night was an absolute fiasco, and there was so much press there. It was very hard to recover off of that.
Right. I mean, I enjoyed the show. I was talking about this. I enjoyed the show, but I felt like something was missing, maybe emotionally, and I felt I found it hard to connect to. And I also remember what I really remember from that show is this: is they played "With or Without You," yeah. and this couple were dancing to it very romantically, as if it was a romantic song. Which is, of course, I mean, if you could just listen to the freaking chorus, you'd know. Yeah. So that, for some reason, that more than anything was what stands in my mind. And that and "Fun Love and Criminal."
Well,
and I remember
"The Edge Karaoke." Do you recall that?
I do recall that. And before we end our YouTube pop discussion and move into Human Touch and Lucky Town, let's hear from Chris, who agrees that pop is underrated. How can we debate if everyone agrees? Chris, what do you think?
Well, I absolutely think that pop is underrated. I believe that the 90s trilogy is very underrated overall.
Mm.
If you look at those three albums, and even pop specifically, if you look at it for the music content itself and not that it was you two performing it, you're going to hear a lot of what was influencing the guys at the time. They were listening to a lot more, you know, Kraftwerk, Prodigy, Orgy, you know, that kind of electronic synth stuff.
Totally.
And they were incorporating it into those three albums at that time, and I think I feel all the tracks are very, very solid. They're tight. They're very well put together. You know, the imagery may have not necessarily been a home run, but you know, I think a lot of people that panned that album and all three of those, and the, whether it be critics or fans, are just like caller Russell had said, you know, they were the ones that were expecting 80s U2.
Right.
Well, at the end of the Joshua the Rattle and Hum tour in 1989, Bono actually had said they did a show in Dublin, and Bono had said to the crowd, "Well, it's time for us to leave and go dream it up all over again."
And that's what
the 90s trilogy.
And that's what they did. Thanks so much for calling in. Have a great day. So we're moving on to Springsteen's Human Touch and Lucky Town, which are about to have their 25th anniversaries at the end of this month. And I think I'm fascinated with these records. I always have been. Human Touch was kind of like the main event in some ways. That he had spent years on it. It reflected a period of writer's block, as we were saying during the break. He had so little music going on that when Roy Bittan, he had just fired or, you know, let go of the E Street Band. He had a new family. Everything was in flux. Then he has dinner with Roy Bittan, the former keyboardist for the E Street Band, and Roy plays him some demos, including this song Roll of the Dice. Basically the backing track to it, a piano riff. And Bruce is like, "This is great. Can I write to this?" And I can only imagine how shocked Roy was, because this is just not how things had worked.
Yeah. And the album started off there and took 2 years. And what Bruce didn't realize was those 2 years from like 90 to 92 were a major turning point in rock music and pop music in general. When he started it, it was a world of like New Kids on the Block and Paula Abdul. And when he put it out, it was a time of Pearl Jam and Nirvana.
Yes, that's a big, big part of it. He made in some ways, Human Touch is his last 80s record.
Right.
It has that slickness of the 80s. It's so perfected. It's dominated by, the irony was, there was an interview with John Landau, Bruce's manager, in Billboard when it came out, and he said, "Well, you know, there's a lot of guitar on this for a 90s record." And it was, I mean, but from his perspective, that was accurate, because he was thinking about the world of Top 40,
yeah.
And no one knows when there's this tidal wave of change coming.
Yeah.
And, you know, when I talked to Bruce last year about his book, we talked a little bit about this period, and, you know, and I said to him, he was talking about how sometimes it's just not your time.
Yeah.
And then I mentioned to him, yeah, like the two tapes I had in my car were Nevermind and Human Touch. I don't think he couldn't have cared less, but I did tell him that.
Yeah.
But
anyway. Well, and there's no memo that you get that it's like a new musical era now and everything's changed. And even though when we look back now, we just think about grunge and everything. If you look at the charts, though, there was still a lot of non-grunge stuff very popular.
Yeah, for sure. And he was an artist who had been in the 80s a chart hit maker. And I think very much the thinking was that he was trying to continue that, which kind of didn't really go with where his artistic instincts were at that point. But, you know, I mean, Human Touch is like when you suggested the idea of pairing this with U2's pop. I think it's really interesting because, like, just as with U2's pop, Human Touch and to a lesser extent Lucky Town are examples of some great songs kind of at least semi-ruined by the arrangements. The classic example is this song Real World from Human Touch, which Matt will get ready for us, because that Real World is this a song I always loved. He debuted it, Springsteen debuted it at the famous Christic Institute concerts in 1990 as this monumental sort of solo piano soul ballad, so powerful. Very slow, stripped down, just him roaring at the piano. And then the album comes out, and we have, we'll see if we have it ready, but just to build up to this, a lot of people, including me, super fans at that point, had the Christic Institute version. We had that, and because he played 57 Channels and Real World. Okay, so imagine you know this song as a raw, stripped down piano vocal extravaganza, and this is what you hear on the record. So I think we can take it from the expert, Mr. Bruce Springsteen, who said that he completely screwed up that arrangement. It was, I mean, it had, you can, it's not like you can see what he was going for and how it could have been cool, but it seems super forced, I think.
Well, and it's the first time he'd ever recorded in the studio. It was with session musicians. This wasn't his band.
Yeah, it wasn't his band. He, you know, he had an ad hoc band, but it was, and you know, the thing is, there are things that Jeff Porcaro, who, the funny thing is, so when he made this record, a lot of people were like, oh, it's the freaking Toto guys. Like, it was, yeah, Jeff Porcaro who played in Toto. But Jeff Porcaro also played on, like, My Gold Teeth by Steely Dan.
No,
like,
he's a sick drummer.
Yeah, like, it's really stupid, actually, to, like, of course he got him. He's an amazing drummer. And listen, there's things he does on the song Human Touch, which I love. I love the song Human Touch. I don't care what anyone says.
No, it's a great song.
So there are things that Jeff Porcaro does on that song that... that Max Weinberg probably couldn't do. The subtleties of lifting and falling. So he wasn't crazy for wanting to do this. It just,
no.
There's also problems, like there's a song called Long Goodbye on Human Touch. And Long Goodbye, I think there's something to it. I think if that song had been earlier in the track listing, I think maybe there's also the outtakes from tracks.
Yeah, which some of them are great, like Sad Eyes and everything. Those are really good songs.
Yeah, I think again, just on like the river and stuff. Let's hear Long Goodbye, because I think for me that's the underrated song. My soul and walking. Yeah, I mean, for me, I mean, the guitars are a little synthetic sounding, but at least it was a bunch of guitars. You don't agree? You
think I can't stand that song. It sounds like shit to me. I mean, I don't know.
Maybe I'm insane. I don't know.
It's not good.
See, I think a lot of this is the other thing is you can get attached to albums that are perhaps unimpeachably bad because of your own emotional connections to it.
Exactly. At a certain age, you lack critical distance.
and then you have trouble adding it back on. I can recognize that. The other problem, and I guess you could say it for that song, but certainly for other things, is there was a certain generic quality that crept in, right?
Right, yeah. And the timing for that, it just couldn't have been worse. I mean, he had true writer's block, and then when he got together, it was... it just didn't come together, which he kind of knew it, which is why he made Lucky Town.
Yes, and that's the thing. Lucky Town is almost uniformly great at song-wise. I think it's too restrained in the playing because he essentially took demos. See, if Human Touch is too polished, Lucky Town is sort of under-polished or undercooked.
Well, and he made it in just 3 weeks. He said that he spent 3 years in the first one and 3 weeks on the second one.
So Lucky Town... man, I mean, there's some great songs on Lucky Town. The title track is killer, I think.
And so is Better Days. But I think a crucial thing to note is that they sound a lot better when they're played by the E Street Band.
Yes. Well, here we have Doug, who thinks that who thinks that Lucky Town and Human Touch are Bruce's two worst albums, which, I that's not a total minority opinion. But tell us why, Doug.
Well, I just think that he lost his way on these two albums. They're very synth-driven albums. Working on a Dream is awful as well, but you guys somehow gave 5 stars to, and I still don't know how.
You're talking to the guy who wrote that review, by the way. So bring it on. But yes, go on.
I don't understand how that got a 5-star review, but
fair enough.
The albums are right with it. And I also, I think at some point you guys are going to have to give John Mellencamp some credit, because this guy's outstanding. He's consistently ignored in your publication.
Well, Doug, it's amazing. There's a lot of coincidences in this call, but one thing is, we originally were going to have John Mellencamp in person here in the studio today. He canceled at the last minute. He had a personal thing, but we're actually hoping to get him back. And I've profiled John, and Andy's profiled John, and we're huge fans. But yeah, he lost his way. I will, and Doug, thanks so much for calling in, and I'm glad you could confront me one on one about Working on a Dream. We'll talk about this sometime. Doug sound a little angry, I think. And Working on a Dream, we can discuss that at some point.
John Mellencamp, I've interviewed him at least 10 times.
Yeah, like, literally, I mean, I will say that John Mellencamp and Andy text sometimes.
That is true.
Yes. So we are, you know, we are unimpeachable about our closeness with John Mellencamp. I've practically babysit his kids once, so for real. But anyway, the critique of Human Touch is synth driven is, I think, valid, Doug, who's no longer on the phone, but that is not valid for, you know, the vast majority of Lucky Town. Lucky Town is essentially a stripped down guitar driven album.
Yeah, and when Bruce played them for Steve Van Zandt, he did not like Human Touch, and he heard Lucky Town, then he was like, that's more like it.
Right, he wanted to re-record Human Touch with the E Street Band, which I can only imagine Bruce's real-time reaction to that. But I think we were saying about Lucky Town, that it sounded better, that all these songs sound better when they're played by the E Street Band. With one of them, I think, again, the mistake or the problem with Lucky Town is he recorded demos and then brought in, like, I think Gary Malabar, actually, not positive how to pronounce that, but he's a former Van Morrison drummer, to sort of replace the drum machine. So, and then, you know, some other people to kind of build around it. So when you do that, when you have rock songs that are built from demos, they're never going to kind of feel expansive. They're never going to really rock. You know, it's not a good way to make a rock album. So, and I think part of it probably was, it came in, I mean, he wrote those songs, like you said, in this burst of inspiration, but then maybe just kind of wanted to record it the same way, especially after, like, the laborious process of Human Touch. So that may have been a mistake.
Yeah, so then he finishes them both, and he goes, okay, I have two new albums here. They're a little different. I don't know what to do. And Guns N' Roses had just done Use Your Illusion 1 and 2 on the same day and had a huge hit with it. So Sony was willing to put them both out on the same day.
Right. It's a fascinating thing. I mean, imagine, you know, people were supposed to go to the store and buy these two CDs. That was the thing. Yeah. I went at midnight. I went in confession hour. I mean, I went at midnight in New Jersey.
Wow.
And there were a lot of people there, man. It was an event. We didn't know that it was the Waterloo here. Like, we did not know. There was a sense. I do actually. That's not totally true though, because when the two singles came out, it was actually because I bought the single. It was Human Touch and Better Days on the flip side of the single, and they had both songs played on the radio that day. Like, on this was an era when there was still, like, classic rock radio would actually kind of play the new song by the Bruce or whoever. So they played it, and I remember the DJ being like, "I don't know about that." Like, that actually happened, and that was the first time when it's like, like maybe, you know, maybe this isn't going to work out.
Yeah, but even Tunnel of Love, I mean, it was a beloved record, but it was nowhere near the Born USA level. So there's definitely a sense that there was a downward
move. There was
move.
Drift. And, you know, part of it was, and then, of course, one of the things that happened with this record was Entertainment Weekly did those records. I keep talking about them as one record, but Entertainment Weekly did an infamous Whatever Happened to Bruce cover, which, believe me, when I was there and then they wanted him back on the cover for The Rising, I think there had to be like a sort of like, well, you know.
Sorry about that whole thing.
Sorry about the whole Whatever Happened to You thing. Can you be on our cover? And to his credit, he did agree. But, you know, again, in a long career, and I hope we have artists who can still have careers like this, you know, decades long careers. Part of the thing, it needs ebb and flow. You have to have those if not low points, those sort of confused moments, those dips, those valleys, right?
Yeah, but the key is that you have to learn from them, and the response is essential. If you just do it again,
yeah,
then you can be gone forever. What he did next was the Ghost of Tom Joad. It was the anti-human touch in every conceivable way.
And, you know, you made a good example of in response to kind of both U2's pop and these Bruce albums, which was their Satanic Majesty's Request, yes, which was kind of a classic stumble, but again, same kind of thing because there are great songs on it.
Yeah.
But classic stumble, and then how did they respond by making Jumpin' Jack Flash and just diving back, yeah, into what you do best.
And what U2 did was in 98, they put out their 80s best of. They put out The Sweetest Thing as a single, and they went right back to the core audience, and they had a radio hit with the Joshua Tree B-side.
Right, and don't forget, you jumped to Ghost of Tom Joad, but what, oh, yeah, actually what Bruce did was he wrote Streets of Philadelphia,
which is a huge hit.
And so he dug into, you know, he dug into the core of his songwriting and also a somewhat modernized sound.
Yeah, it was like his knocking on heaven's door for Dylan when Dylan was adrift. He got a soundtrack,
right,
and wrote one great song for a soundtrack. He put all his energy into one song, basically, and they both managed to use that as a jumping off point for the next few years.
It is amazing. I mean, with Bruce, like, people were just, you know, and it was such a weird time to be a Bruce fan as a young person, because people were like, you like Bruce Springsteen? Like, it was, yeah, so, even in New Jersey, it was such a weird, so then, and then 2 years later, he turns around and has that Oscars moment and has this song that's everywhere that's actually a pop, and it just shows how quickly, yeah, things turn around. So this has been Rolling Stone Music Now. We were talking about U2's pop and Bruce Springsteen's Human Touch and Lucky Town, and we took some calls, and we hope to do that going forward. We'll be back next Friday at 1 p.m. with the next episode of Rolling Stone Music Now. And in the meantime, you can download us as a podcast at rollingstone.com/podcast or wherever you get your podcasts. And we will see you next week. Thanks so much for listening. Have a great weekend.